And I'm over here. Right, okay. So we're on several platforms. So I'm going to be doing a bit of this again. Welcome back. We're going back into lockdown. So I thought, why not do these weekly live biomechanics Q&As? They went down really well before. When I stopped them, everybody asked why I'd stopped doing them. So I think that people felt them useful, which is great. That's fantastic. A few of the same faces coming along. So hi there, Instagram. If you do have any questions, you can post them. Forgive me if I missed them, because I'm on three platforms here. I have written down the ones that came in originally when I went through, when I sort of put up that I was going to start these. And by the way, anybody's watching, this is going to be every week during lockdown, Wednesday, 12 till 1, unless something in my schedule scuppers that. But it's aimed at personal trainers, manual therapists, strength coaches, Pilates teachers, yoga teachers, anybody involved in movement, physios, osteos, podiatrists, who want to professionally discuss biomechanics or common questions that come up. Now, predominantly, the people I usually speak to across social media are, like myself, exercise professionals, personal trainers, strength coaches are from that field. But if anybody watching this is from a different field, let us know. It's great when you can have open discussions around diverse subjects, but all relating to the human body. So we've got the dog body there in the background, got my mascot there, you can see. Roxy. So please feel free to post any questions you've got. I'm going to open up the chat box, Tom, because I know you often ask really good questions. So we've got about six, a couple of which actually cross over a little bit, which is great because it enables me to tick a couple of boxes just coming from a different viewpoint. Just have a quick look on Instagram. I've got my screen facing the window and the sun's just come round, so forgive me if I'm a little bit out of focus. So Instagram, if you've got any questions, give us a shout, let me know. Just having a quick look. Yeah, okay. So we're going to go for about 40-45 minutes. What I would encourage you to do whilst watching a video or listening is to get up. So if you're sitting or harm, I can see you're doing your mobility work, so that's great. Get up, move around, and stick your headset on. There may well be visual stuff, I don't know. We'll see how we go with the questions coming in. And you can ask questions as we go. Hiya, Robbie. At any point, some of the questions are interesting. And what I find, I remember when we did this last time, when we went into lockdown, the questions are usually relatively big and ambiguous. And so I'm going to highlight that on this again, because the questions that have come in are going to enable me to do that. And then those who've asked the questions can elaborate a little bit more, maybe expand on them more and enable me to discuss them in more detail. Because usually people have something very specific in mind when they ask a generic question. So let me start with the first one. From Premraj, sorry if I've got your name wrong or not pronounced it right, and he's asked about, can I talk about the biomechanics of the lower extremity, which is a huge question. So sorry Premraj, but I would need to know a hell of a lot more information before we can actually have a conversation about the biomechanics of the lower extremities. Because what you've got there is the ankle, the knee, the pelvis, maybe, if you want to include that. But I need to understand why you want to know more. And if I understand the roots of your question, i.e. why are you asking, what problem are you trying to solve? That then allows me to elaborate further. So to help you initiate that question with something useful, I've just launched the first part one, excuse me, of a series of blogs that I'm going to write and videos I'm going to add in as well, that are all based around practical anatomy, practical biomechanics, and understanding why we need to know a bit about bony landmarks and muscles and actions when we can see what flexion and extension looks like. So I know that goes against what I've always taught you guys, which is forget the anatomy, understand movement. But I'll flip that on its head for now, because that's what I do as an educator, is challenge everything that I'm teaching you. So let's challenge the concept and let's get into the nitty gritty in those blogs of what the bony landmarks mean, the PSIS, the ASIS, are they useful? What do they tell us? Knowing which muscle does what, how does that interplay? So the first blog was launched last week. I forgot what day it is. Lockdown throws it all in there. Every day is a Sunday in lockdown. I think it was last week, and it was the pelvis biomechanics, and it was the bones, so the focus on the bones of the hip, including, I think we included the top of the femur, I can't remember. If I didn't, I'll do that next time. And then sort of going through how to use tactics to memorize anatomy that might be useful, because I think when there's so much to learn, it's almost like it's overwhelmed right at the beginning. So I've tried to break it down to key aspects that might help us remember some of it better. And I think the more we remember our anatomy, it can help us in our confidence when working with a client and things don't go as we perceive they should or we expect them to. So the first question wasn't really a question. It was kind of like biomechanics of lower extremity. So go and start with that one. Go to the website, www.biomechanicseducation.com, click blog, look at the last one, second to last one. I think I've just done another one, which is an in-betweeny because of lockdown. But you'll see part one, pelvis biomechanics, the bones. So you can go and have a read of that. If you want to subscribe, you can do that on the homepage. So with that, we'll come into the second question, which came in from my friend Toki. And he talked about, well, he said, techniques to cope with shoulder / neck impact trauma, which causes tingle in ring and little finger. And then he's put brachioplexus ? So again, Toppy, I'm afraid it's a huge question. And the caveat to begin with would be, you need to see a clinician. You need to have a diagnosis. You need to be fully evaluated. I would not do that online with somebody in pain who's not been through a full clinical analysis to rule out red flags. So that's caveat number one. Toppy, I know you'll know all that. So to come into the second aspect that I would sort of say to any trainer or coach, if a client comes to you and says, I had trauma, I had impact to the neck and shoulders, number one, obviously, get checked out. If they're clear for movement, it would then be an understanding of the relationship with the neck and this area of the body anatomically. So the neck has, and Top has mentioned it here, brachioplexus, sort of group of nerves that come down through the neck and feed down into the arm, which is where he's talking about these symptoms, tingling in the ring and the little finger. So if you understand anything about the brachioplexus, there are three key nerves in the arm, the median nerve, the radial nerve, and the ulnar nerve. And it's the ulnar nerve, in particular, that relates to the ring finger and the little finger. So the only thing I can probably add in here, Toppy, is that the any whatever the trauma impact was that you had with your neck, shoulder, it sounds like it's influencing the ulnar nerve. Now, what that doesn't give you is the solution. And that is where you should be seeking medical advice or clinician's advice. Or if you've been cleared for exercise, the consideration would be, how can I help you move better to take tension off this area? So this is where I get to advise as biomechanics coaches, the way we practice is you don't do anything for the problem area. You would come away from that area just in case there's anything sinister there that the clinicians have missed, or you'd be working with the clinician while they treat this area. What we would do is make sure the pelvis and the spine move really well, that takes tension off the shoulder. The instinct that we all have when a client comes to us with a problem in a certain area, and this depends on your skill set, so bear with me a moment, is to treat test, treat and exercise the problem area. And that, a clinician, that's what they're insured and covered to do. That's their job. As a movement professional, it isn't our job, depending on the severity and red flags and everything else. But let's take this in consideration. If somebody's had trauma on their neck and shoulder, the first point of contact should be a clinician to be cleared of any red flags. As a movement professional, as an exercise professional, we're not in our basic training given the skills to evaluate when somebody's had an accident or trauma, whether anything, whether there's a red flag that we need to address clinically. We're not an allied professional. So there are kind of, obviously, there's the black and white and then there's a grey area. I'm talking about the black and white. Somebody's had an injury, they need to go and see a clinician, get cleared. If they're cleared and they come to us, then our role is to consider how do we help this client who has a neck shoulder problem that's causing tingling in the finger. The instinct might be to mobilise the ulnar nerve. I would recommend you come away from that area and you actually affect the shoulder and the neck by improving the movement in the pelvis and spine first. And the reason being that holds far less risk, increases the confidence of the client in terms of they're not moving the sore bit, and reduces risk in case there is anything residual that's going on in there, and then that loses our confidence and the client's confidence. The challenge for us is to try and instill in the client why we're doing that, and to help them understand that the body is an integrated system. And we all know that, you know, if you move the pelvis, if you watch my logo, if I move my pelvis over here, then that logo will shift. You know, you just pull on your jumper and you can see how the links through the myofascial chains, the way the bones sit together, the nerves influence the whole body. We can influence shoulder function by improving this function of the pelvis and the spine. So Toppy, you know your stuff, you know I move freely. Crack on with that stuff, avoid the nerve stuff in the arm until or unless you're seeing your clinician friend. I'd be interested to know what they're suggesting. When it comes to manual therapists, I would be saying, again, depending on what level you're trained at, similar. I would be giving similar advice, affect the pelvis and the spine areas. Maybe there would be some gentle treatment through the neck and shoulder if you felt it was appropriate through your testing and your skill set and there wasn't any risk. Because of course, if your shoulder is sore or your arm is sore, that's kind of instinctively where we want somebody to treat. Right now, under the current climate, that is almost impossible for a lot of professionals. Some practitioners do have permission to go ahead. And so it's understanding your approach, your level, risk, and everything else that interplays in that. And Toppy's question actually helps me come on to Chris's question, which was about, and again, it was a bit ambiguous and generic, sorry, Chris, about movement with the neck, and then he mentioned whiplash. And I know a little bit about Chris's background. So understanding how whiplash could have been the trauma that Toppy was talking about, maybe it wasn't, but how they link together. If you've ever had, anybody ever had whiplash? I have, and one of the best ways, yeah, Robbie, one of the best ways to reduce the impact, excuse the pun, of whiplash is to have strong neck. Now, we don't, as coaches and trainers, instinctively think of strengthening a client's neck unless they're a rugby player. But then the way you would strengthen the neck could be done in ways that you may not imagine. So let me just try and come backwards to go forwards again. If you have whiplash, again, you need to see a clinician first and you need to get a full diagnosis just to make sure there is nothing sinister, blah, blah, blah. If you're then told to exercise, then there's a good chance, if it's not really severe, that gentle mobility techniques will help to loosen off where whiplash, you're familiar with whiplash, guys. Sorry, let's just go back again. It can be caused mostly if you think about it as a car accident. So you hit in the back, somebody shunts you and you shunt forwards and back and you get a reaction in the neck muscles that causes residual stiffness. You can get, so stiff, sore, loss of range of movement, headaches, tenderness, fatigue, or dizziness. So when I had it, I was just tender for about 10 days, I think it was, and I was doing gentle exercises, and then I was fine. I was cleared by a doctor, and I had a claim on insurance. And so that paid for all the treatment, for any time off work. And you may get funds for treatment as well. And so as long as you go through that, and that's fine. If it's more severe, so other symptoms can be blurred vision, tinnitus, irritability, lack of concentration, poor memory, and depression as well can be a part of the symptoms. So this makes it much bigger than just simply an exercise issue. Movement is obviously key, but there may be other remedies that can help with symptoms of whiplash, as per sort of Chris and Toppy's questions. So depending on symptoms, and this is where we need to work alongside the clinicians to understand where the roles fit in. But controlling the pain, obviously, through the clinicians with painkillers, and that may be over the counter, it may be prescribed. Range of movements, so gentle movement techniques. Sometimes muscle relaxants, which is going to be from a clinician, of course, and sometimes TENS or therapy. So that would be sort of ways to think about it. I guess coming into back to what I was trying to say in the beginning, as an exercise professional, one of our jobs is to ensure that our clients are strong and robust and fit for purpose. And fit for purpose is also to protect the body when we might be in a car accident. Whiplash can be caused by rugby, boxing, even falling over. If you imagine an elderly person falling to the ground and not having neck strength, the head could actually whiplash as the body hits the floor. So these kind of symptoms can come about from all the kind of demographics that we have in our client base. So how do we make somebody strong and robust to either reduce the symptoms of impact, whiplash, and make them strong should an accident occur in a car, falling over, or if they're a rugby player, the most common thing we think of is neck strength exercises. So let me just chuck this at you guys, those who are watching over on Instagram, Facebook, and in Zoom. Chris, this might be a good one for you. To understand what, apart from, if you imagine a rugby player's neck strength routine, what ways do you think we could strengthen the neck of an 80-year-old? Because it's more commonly thought of in rugby. I don't know if you've seen where you would tie a band around the head, Rambo style, maybe have a weight on it, and then, you know, move the head around. So in rugby, that may be appropriate. But what about an 80-year-old or somebody who's older who you're not going to do it? You might do that. You might have an 80-year-old rugby player. I don't know. But how can we strengthen the neck of the average client, and why would we, and what would that look like, to reduce neck injuries or trauma and have strong muscles? And the point of strong muscles isn't just simply for aesthetics or the way we look. It is to reduce risk, and particularly in the neck, the risk on the cervical spine and the soft tissue within it, spinal cord, and obviously the plexus and everything else around that. So you can tap away, Harm. I can see, I'm hoping you're tapping away, Harm, to get some interaction. Those who know me know that I like interaction rather than just me lecturing, which is kind of hard on a video monologue. So how could we strengthen the neck of a client who maybe, I'm giving that example because they're the one you might be less likely to tie a weight to their head and get them to do loaded neck motions. But how could we strengthen the neck? And it may not be what you think. I want you to try and think outside the box. What movement would it be easiest to give to a client like an older generation client who might need a strong neck to stop them getting whiplash if they fell over How could we strengthen it? So Harb says, a McGill curl-up for younger people and just a regression for older people lying on the sofa. So is that supine, prone, side-lying? What would be your start position, Harb? See if anyone's responding over on Instagram. Hiya, Christopher. Nice to see you in here. We've got lots of Chris's. Okay. So just waiting for that response. So a McGill curl-up, sorry. If you describe a McGill curl-up in terms of anatomical movements, because not everybody will be familiar with McGill, who the hell's he? And not everybody will be familiar with a curl-up. Is it from the front up? Is it from the back up? And how does that look? So anybody on Instagram, if you drop it in, you can join in as well. The question is, how do we strengthen and why would we strengthen the neck of somebody who's 80 plus years old? So looking at a McGill curl-up. Anybody who's not come across Stuart McGill, just because I'm assuming it's Stuart McGill because I know you're a fan, Hom. Stuart McGill is a world-leading biomechanist and specialises in spine biomechanics. He's a Canadian professor at Waterloo University. He's got a fantastic moustache. And he has written lots of books that can help us understand spine biomechanics and load. Some of them are clinical low back pain books, but a really great one that he launched specifically for people like us is Ultimate Back Fitness and Performance, which I've got somewhere. Find that for you. Got it somewhere. No, I'm not going to find it. I can't find it. I should have prepared, but I didn't know it was going to come up. Ultimate Back Fitness and Performance. Okay. So supine or semi-supine. Laying on the bed or the floor and then curling up. Is that what you mean, Harm? Right, okay. So what Harm is suggesting for an 80-year-old to have a strong neck from lying, supine, and then curling up, what muscles are going to lift that head off the pillow or the floor or the sofa? Of course, it's going to be the neck flexors. And so that might be a way, if you imagine the average head weighs, I think it's around 8 pounds or so, that's going to be appropriate. We might do isometrics, we might do it slowly, we might do it from a supine position, just to play devil's advocate with Harm. You might lie them on the front and ask them to lift the face off the floor, and you might be on the side to work the extensors and the lateral flexors of the neck as well. It becomes appropriate to the individual because they've just got to get the head off the pillow. It might be an isometric, it might be repetitions, and again, that would be down to you, the client and the context and the individual and their ability and their level. But these kind of techniques, we don't think of a curl-up as a neck strength exercise. We think of it as an abdominal exercise. But what is holding the head in place when you curl up is the neck muscles. So actually, by curling up and using your spine flexors in the abdominal area lower down, you are inadvertently using an isometric, depending on how much your neck is moving, loaded neck flexion strength technique at the top end. So did that all make sense? I'm not sure if that all came out right. So literally doing a curl-up, I would agree with Harm, is a logical way that is specific to that client. So just to come back to Toppy and Chris's questions about whiplash, for those guys, they're both, Chris is much younger, Toppy's more my age, but both are fit, robust, certainly have been before any accidents. Fit and robust, healthy adults, for them, it may be that they can take advantage of that style of considering how to strengthen the neck at the low risk end, somebody with whiplash or coming out of whiplash or with a neck injury under the guidance of their clinician or their healthcare practitioner who is from the clinical side and, you know, understands any trauma or any injury that's going on inside their upper body. So kind of, again, as I say, that was a big loaded question from Chris Phillips. So hopefully we got kind of something out of that. Chris also said, and again, sorry, Chris, ambiguous. He talked about balance and proprioception. So I don't know, I do know a bit of his history, but I don't know what the question was about balance and proprioception. So just to talk about that a little bit since he's asked, balance and proprioception, I think for the types of demographics we're talking about here with for lower extremities, to go back to the original question, biomechanics, people with injuries, people who are high risk, people who are in pain, to understand the value and the input of proprioception and balance is a key factor in both prehab and post-rehab, or even rehab actually. But for us as exercise professionals, post-rehab or prehab. So balance and proprioception kind of go together. Proprioception is about your body's understanding of where it is in space. And we often think about this more when somebody's had an injury, but actually somebody who's new to exercise. You remember the client who was brand new to exercise and the first time you asked them to squat and that kind of like it looks really weird, or even lunge and that their body's all over, or even for yourselves. It was a long time ago for me, but I vaguely remember when I first started moving, things felt really weird. So your body is proprioceptively not familiar with that move or that position. Or if you take up a new sport, you know, if you stick a tennis racket in my hand, I would be clueless. You know, it's kind of like, oh, right, okay. But then proprioceptively, each time I play, my body is becoming more familiar with the movement, the actions, what it feels like, the sensory input, the grip around the bat, the weight of the bat, the force when the ball hits, where my feet are positioned. And a lot of this is quite subconscious and just reactive. And the brain is adapting how the tissues add tone around the joints so that the proprioception becomes more familiar. And over time, we start to improve. So anybody who's tried Olympic lifting will be very familiar with the technical application of proprioceptive adaption. So strength sports like Olympic lifting, snatch, clean or jerk, are seen as needing strength. But really, right at the very beginning, the proprioception of just literally using a pole to feel the movements, you know, as you lift through the body, and adding in the top-down technique of proprioceptively setting the body up for layering on top, then the progression would be the kilos. And so you've got the two aspects of balance and proprioception, to Chris Phillips' original question, coming into a new movement and coming out of an injury, you're effectively retraining back lost movement, or it may be a new movement coming out of an injury. So I don't know if that helps with the original question, but a little bit around that. If there's any more questions on that, please do write or post, and it can feed into maybe next week's live Q&A. And then Harm, love your questions, Harm, all the time. Really unique questions, and I really like them, so thank you for those. So Harm is asking about what are the common muscles in the body to become inhibited? And it's a really great question. It's also a huge question. But I do have, I think, a kind of evidence-based response. And she also asked, just to put this all into context as well, what sports cause inhibitions? So I'll answer these in sequence, but just to enable me to explain from an evidence-based perspective. For 30 years, a colleague of mine, who's a chartered physiotherapist, did research to understand his elite clients. He also had non-elite clients, so Barry's and Ethel's in his gym, and their biomechanical performance. He tested on both isokinetic machines, but also with manual tests. And he wanted to understand how to predict injury. So as a physiotherapist, he had diagnostic tools to understand the problem once it had happened. Oh, okay, you have a sore shoulder as a result of playing tennis or throwing a javelin, and this is what I've diagnosed from this test. He wanted to try and prevent the injury in the first place. He had elite level athletes who needed to perform on the day, and a very famous one, Derek Redmond, back in 92 in the Barcelona Olympics, who very famously injured his, or went down like a sack of spuds, lost the gold medal because of an injury that occurred And as a result, Martin suspected of poor biomechanics that were coming from his hips, that he felt if he'd been able to assess him, he might have been able to prevent that problem from happening. So the study that he did on 4,500 subjects over 20 plus years gave him indicators of key muscles within the body that he was able to test clinically and understand which ones were more commonly problematic prior to getting an injury. So they were indicative of when an injury might be at risk of occurring. So he put together a series of tests that then enabled him to test those muscles, and I'm going to use that term loosely, and I'll explain why in a minute, to identify what he should do to improve the movement of that muscle so that they have less risk of an injury. So I hope that all makes sense. So it's from an evidence-based perspective. So the key areas, or the key muscles, if you like, and just to challenge everything I've just said, it would be impossible to truly identify, because no matter what movement we ask a client to do, we actually don't know exactly which muscles in that client are performing that movement. Let me try and explain that in a little bit more detail. If internal rotation was a problem in a test, so you test into the internal rotators, we could say that's a subscapularis problem, because subscapularis we might consider as the internal rotator of the arm. And that is one of the tests, as an example, that we teach on one of our workshops. That was a key muscle that Martin identified that could be a problem in his javelin thrower, let's say Daley Thompson, that when that muscle tested as being limited, he knew he needed to do a subscapularis technique to improve the function of that muscle so that then he didn't get the injury when he threw the javelin. But just to challenge that, subscapularis is not the only internal rotator of the arm. And so the better you know your anatomy, the better this will all make sense. So I'm going to try and simplify it. The test for subscapularis is basically a test of external rotation of the arm. There are other muscles that can limit external rotation of the arm. And so I'm not going to go into that. I'm going to let you go. That's your homework, everybody. Tell me what the internal rotators of the arm are. That's your homework, actually. You asked the question. But a key player would be subscapularis. But in truth, nobody would know specifically which muscles are the most common muscles to be inhibited, because you can't separate the internal rotators of the arm. Subscapularis is a key one. We classify that as a subscapularis test. But technically, in truth, it's an external rotation test with the arm abducted to 90 in that position, of which subscapularis is a key player, but there could be others involved. And the original test was actually for pec major as well, which is one of the other muscles that will be involved in limiting that movement. But we took pec major out because we felt that in that movement, in that position, what we understand of pec major and subscapularis as internal rotators being lengthened, we felt it was more true to subscapularis than pec major. If you want to understand what I've just talked about, then you need to go and explore your anatomy knowledge of pec major and subscapularis and let me know what you think. I'd be interested to know. In short, we can't truly answer that question. However, the tests that we deliver on our course, the reason we deliver the specific tests we deliver is because when Martin did his research, he found that they were the key areas of the body, muscles, if you like, probably to be more technically accurate, movements that became limited through daily living, our daily lives. And so we wanted to improve those movements. And that worked. And so that's where it comes from. So I'm not copping out, but you understand what I mean by that. And then your second question, what sports cause inhibitions? I would say, what do you think? Because There's so many sports, and I think, again, a loaded question. So I'm going to give you a generic view back, because unless I know a specific reason why you're asking, unless you give me something very specific, I'm going to be generic. Sport is actually probably not good for our body. Did I just drop the mic then? Let me clarify. Subheading to this video, sport's not good for you. Right, let me explain. Sport is exactly that. It's a sport. It's an activity. It's a non-essential activity that we choose to take up either because we lack natural movement or we want to compete either with ourselves or with somebody else. Quite often in sport, it's asymmetrical in its application. So football, we have a favourite leg. Tennis, we use one arm generally, unless you're ambiguous and clever. Snooker, I mean, I'm trying to be generic here. Or it's repetitive. So running, maybe over long distances, or if it's fast, it's fast impact work. The training is repetitive through a single plane of motion. So sport technically isn't good for the body. Obviously, it's better than being totally static, but I'm just trying to expand on the definition of sport, exercise, and movement. Movement is a big heading for sport and exercise, but they are not all about, they're not the only ways to move. So we can move, we move through daily living. You'll notice I'm a fidget pants. I'm really trying hard not to move, actually. Because I've watched some of my videos, I'm like, oh my God, Rach, stand still. And then I think, well, I'm encouraging people to move more. So movement is a big heading that has underneath it categories of movement. Sport, work, you could put cleaning in there, exercise. There's different types of exercise, even subheadings underneath those. And please understand what I'm saying when I say sport isn't good for you. Sport is usually, exercise is a replacement usually for lost capacity of movement. Those who are inactive want to exercise to lose weight. If they just moved around more, they would lose weight if they burn more calories than they consume, which is where personal trainers have a big market. Exercise is also useful to get stronger, and that is usually because we're not using our body in a way that a hunter-gatherer might squat and run after a saber-toothed tiger and carry it back and chop it up and squat on our haunches to eat it and build our fire. So we lose a natural amount of strength. Exercise we also use to be aesthetically pleasing. So we sit a lot, and so our buttocks drop away, our pelvis tilts under or the other way, or whatever. Our spine goes into this ligamentous creep of thoracic flexion. It can become a hyperkyphosis. And so exercise is usually a replacement, whereas sport, and this crosses into exercise, can be a competitive, hobby. It can be for an athlete, a profession. But it can be something that we do because we enjoy it. Generally, sport is for enjoyment. It's for the pleasure rather than the outcome. Bodybuilding, you could argue, is for the outcome of the aesthetics. But you can train for aesthetics without competing. So there's so many avenues to go down. So let's come back to the original question. What sports cause inhibitions? Probably all of them. To some degree, it's going to depend how prepared the athlete or client is for that sport. Is it more asymmetrical and so going to emphasize one side of the body to the other? Is it repetitive? Is it single plane? Is it just sagittal and there's no frontal plane training? And so we need to consider that. So sort of how we take that back into our application is, I guess, that's what maybe Harm is trying to get to, is in application, how does that help me? Obviously, Harm, you're switched on as a practitioner, I know that. Understanding the client, the desire, what is movement? what is exercise and what is sport, because they are not the same things. The movement is then categorized by types of movement, of which sport and exercise are two. And then you could categorize those again underneath: tennis, rugby, football, Olympic weightlifting, swimming, walking. Exercise could be brackets of those, but then it could be bodybuilding, it could be 5-day split, it could be Olympic lifting, it could be walking, it could be Zumba. So there's so many other categories. So we need to understand all of this of our clients and then their goal, and then identify risk through evaluation and assessment of their movement quality, and then have interventions, a broad toolbox of interventions to then pull in and use when we see fit. Did I answer your question? thanks, Robbie. It was a rather long and I guess maybe you guys are pulling my leg when you ask me these generic questions, because you know I've got to kind of go off on one. I don't know whether that's a good thing. So hey, ask for about clients with migraines. My apologies, hey, I'm probably not going to be able to answer that one, because that is down to context. There is no generic advice. See a practitioner, see a GP, and then find out whether you need a painkiller or whatever else. Migraines are horrendous. I've never had one, but I've got two close friends who literally, lights off, shut the curtains, no sound, into bed. And so I know they are quite disabling, and I have no experience of what to do about it other than CGP, painkillers, and then all that stuff. So it's not my field, I'm sorry. And then Sandeep asked how to improve calf muscles. So my question back to Sandeep would be, why do you want to improve your calves? Is it size, range, function, power, strength? Why do you want to improve your calves? So just to broaden on that large question, because I know Robbie likes the long answers. Most of us, again, down to lifestyle and the things we wear, have problematic calves in terms of range, function and growth. So their strength, their power production. And yet the calves are, the soleus is one of the biggest pumps in the body that is supposed to push oxygenated, deoxygenated blood around the body. It's to push blood back up to the heart to be reoxygenated and put back through the body. So if it doesn't function very well, it has broad potential for limiting us. You're very welcome, Har. So in terms of the calf muscles, the calves we think of as the soleus and the gastroc. The soleus is predominantly the plantar flexor. They're both plantar flexors, but when you look at them, we think of the gastroc as the big one, because you've got the kind of the teardrop look, and they're the ones you see at the top. Soleus underneath is actually the big one that travels all the way up the back of the lower leg. If you have calves like mine, the gastrocs are much longer, and then some present very short gastroc and long soleus, usually kind of Afro-Caribbean. Those Kenyan runners have those very long, or the sprinters, you look at Usain Bolt's long soleus. So you've got a genetic impact of how those two muscles produce movement, predominantly as plantar flexion, but also to consider in calf limitation, shoes, and most trainers will have a good inch or so on the bottom of elevating the heel in terms of opening up the ankle range. They lift the heel a little bit off the floor, unless you're in, you know, barefoot or the types of shoes that are out there that claim, you know, zero lift in their shoe. By the way, no shoe suits everybody. So understanding that a heel raise, don't just bin your shoes. So if you do have high heels, which is trainers as well as the high heels, the 6 inches, girls, boys as well, maybe, they are going to limit the amount that the foot is familiar with a dorsiflexion range at the ankle. So the soft tissue across the back of the ankle can start to adapt a little bit. Also, sitting will hold the knee in a degree of flexion where your gastroc comes up. And so there can be a limitation in blood flow and everything else. So understanding static posture. And so this can all limit muscle growth. So if you're a bodybuilder and you want big calves, a lot of the UK guys struggle with the lower limbs. And I don't know if this is to do with the fact that we're in a colder country and we don't wear shorts as much. You know the tricep boys? These guys, the tricep boys, chest and biceps day, usually on a Monday. the focus is on the aesthetic muscles that you can see. And so they don't worry about the legs until it comes to the summer. They do a bit of leg work. Whereas the Europeans generally have bigger calves. I'm sure there's some genetic history in that. But it could be about the way we're training and the guys are, you know, wearing long trousers, shorts over in Europe. I don't know. I'm just being observant here in terms of how we present. But in terms of muscle growth, a key factor in, I believe, that kind of posterior muscular group, calves, hamstrings, glutes, etc., a key factor in their function is the nervous system, the neural system. And there's a lot of evidence, and in my professional experience, I've had a huge amount of response to muscle growth, muscle function, the improvement of muscle tone and ranges in muscles of flexibility through mobilizing the nervous system. Huge amount of research showing that nerve tension will inhibit muscle function. The nerves talk to the muscles protect the nervous system. So if you have a limitation in your neural system, the glutes, the hamstrings, the calves, they're going to just hang on a little bit to protect you from damaging the nerves. The muscles can repair, the nerves can't. So if you have tension in QL, glutes, anybody with sciatica, those kind of issues, or presenting with those kind of discomforts or limitations, tight hamstrings, tight calves, tight QL, hips, this combination of nerve tension, muscle inhibition can really limit function. So rather than just strength work and mobility work, joint mobility, consider all the other structures and players in quality of movement. So coming back to the original question, Sandy, how to improve calf muscles. Hopefully that gives an opening to maybe coming back with a more specific question that helps. Oh, Sandy, you're in. Thank you, Sandeep. Did that help, by the way? I know your question was there a specific, did I answer your question? He's over on Instagram, so let me just run back and check. You're very welcome. It looks like, yeah, he's, okay, great, fantastic. So by mobilizing the nervous system, improve muscle tone, use muscle energy techniques, low energy stuff, nerve mobilization, get the joints moving. If you're going to come out of heeled shoes, do it gradually, wean out, and make sure your feet can cope without shoes. And that may or may not be right for you. Don't feel like because everybody else is wearing zero sole shoes that you should. It isn't good for everyone. I'm a bit old now to wean out. I do spend time barefoot, but that causes me problems higher up. And so it's understanding the client, what they're trying to achieve. But for muscle growth, get everything. I've done this recently, actually, two examples, two bodybuilders. One was, phenomenal physique, symmetry, size, immense, just stunning physique. But he was always marked down for his hamstrings, always concerned about his hamstrings in comparison to the symmetry with his quads. And so I gave him the four sign test, quad dominance test and the sciatic nerve test. Just those, this was just a quick sort of online consultation. And then I had no history, no injuries, no problems. And then he got onto the porcine muscle release, the slump nerve mobilization, and also pure isolated knee flexion loading. And literally his first hamstring session, he messaged me straight away and he was like, mind blown, my hamstrings have never felt like that. The pump was phenomenal. It's you know, this is a really conditioned trainer who knows what he's doing. And it was just that one little, there's no magic exercise. It was just, he was just missing a little bit of something. And so he's super happy. They're just an example. That was hamstrings, but I think you could relate that down to the calves as well, Sandy. So understanding how to test, retest, try an intervention, new interventions is a key component, I think. So that's all the questions that I had in. I'm just going to pause and see. Chris, Honor, have you got any questions? I know you're sitting there quietly listening in. Thanks for letting your mate know as well, by the way. I'm just going to scroll back through Instagram. Anybody in there? Excuse my gormy face whilst I scroll back, see if there's any questions. I don't think there are. Facebook over there, I'm not reading you just now. So if you can bear with me. Any questions I've missed, I will look back later on and I will endeavour to answer them. If I'm not answering them now, I look like your mum. Brilliant. She's an attractive woman, eh, Sandy? any that I've missed, I will endeavour to do next week. But please let me know if this is helpful. Please post your questions. Please make them as specific as you can. What I want to understand from your question is why you're asking it. If I understand why you're asking the question, it enables me to be more specific. If you're being generic, that's fine. You've got the impression as to the way I answer a generic question. I think Robbie likes my generic sweeping responses. That's fine, but it will be generic. And so understand it's a challenge online without seeing the client to understand, obviously, both specifics and generics. So hopefully these are helpful. Just trying to help during lockdown. Outside of a biomechanics Q&A, what help do you guys need? Do you need, I'm setting up some webinars. They're anything from £7 to £27. Some of them are free, depends on who's delivering, it's not just me. Some business gurus, we've got Chris Wright, we've got Pete Banbury, the body mapper. I've got Lee Haven from the Platinum Training Institute. So body mapping, mindset, mental health, business. And I'm trying to pull my colleagues, my buddies together to bring you as much online free content or low cost content as we can. But what do you need? What's going to help you in your businesses right now, particularly, and moving forwards? But over these 4 weeks, a lot of you now have some time on your hands. That is a shame if you're losing income. And I feel for you. I'm so sorry about that. Let's try and make it productive. Can we help? What can we do? What can I do? What can they do? I'll write that one down, Chris. We'll do that next time. Thanks, Robbie. Yeah, no problem. Can you do me a favor as well? Can you let others know about this? So I'll do a post midweek and then I'll do it again on the morning of or the day before. Just share it in the groups. Let others know. I just want to help. Genuinely, I could talk this stuff all day. I would rather have conversations with you all, do this in a classroom. But if this is the way it's done and if it's helpful, great. What would be more helpful? Post all your questions. Guys, please stay safe. Just remember, we have a duty of care. If you can get your service online, please do, because our communities need us. They still need our help. So don't feel that your service is watered down. Of course, it's better in person. But whatever you can get online, help your people. Charge a lower rate, charge a little mini subscription fee, get a Facebook private group together, charge a tenner a month, 20 quid a month, load of content in there. And then your guys are gonna know that even when the shit hit the fan, that you were there, that you cared. Your other clients, you know, you can carry on and do your online thing, but some people are gonna lose their own income. How can we help these guys? What can we do? Go for it. Don't be afraid, but can we help with the technology? I always need help with technology. I'm looking at three screens here. So I'm going to stop talking. Please share. next week, back in, post your questions. See you next time. Stay safe. Look after each other. Goodbye, guys. Take care. And on Insta, take care, guys.